we talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took 5 loaves and 2 fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues, etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
The modern left has grown tired of debate. Their new strategy is simply to try to silence their critics.
When the local evangelical pastor gets up and ends his prayer with a reference to Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross, that moment in the parade of pluralism is offensive.
Sin essentially is high treason against the king, against the sovereign.
Your sins are forgiven. Though you're a rotten, damned sinner of the law, Jesus came for such sinners. Jesus loves sinners. Jesus comes only for sinners. Jesus dwells in sinners. Jesus is for you. You're forgiven.
I'm Daniel Berquist. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm a Macintosh software engineer. And I love Issues, Etc.
There's no doubt that the now decades-long priestly abuse scandal in the Roman Catholic Church has made for a lot of very careful rethinking about the legal ramifications of such a thing. How could it go on this long? Who is responsible? Now, there's a committee of the UN that says the Vatican is ultimately responsible for the action of every one of its priests. Is that true? Is that legally true? And they have put teeth in this accusation by claiming that the Vatican has violated a UN treaty on torture. They've classified this as torture, along with a couple other things that are rather odd. Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. On this Wednesday afternoon, May the 28th, I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to spend the first few minutes with Lee Casey, co-author of a recent column for the Wall Street Journal titled Using a Torture Claim Against the Catholic Church, about a UN claim of torture against the Vatican. You can call us for the next 2 hours of the program, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. A little bit later, we'll talk Christian marriage and fellowship. Pastor John Drosendahl will be our guest. Chris Roseborough, Fighting for the Faith, will join us to bring us an update on the controversy surrounding a prominent evangelical church in Seattle and the removal of a pastor from a network of Reformed churches. Robert Spencer will be our guest after that. We'll talk about what you've probably read about in the paper, the stoning to death of a pregnant woman in Pakistan. How does that happen? Then Terry Mattingly, author of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, will be our guest to talk about media coverage of Pope Francis's recent trip to the Middle East. Oddly enough, the big three, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, didn't actually discuss at any length the real reason for the Pope's visit. They did talk a lot about the visit, but not the real reason for it. We'll see what Terry thinks about that in the last few minutes of Issues, Etc. Joining us to talk about a UN claim of torture against the Vatican, Lee Casey. He's an attorney in Washington, D.C., formerly served in the Justice Department during the Reagan and Bush administrations, and he's co-author of a recent column for the Wall Street Journal, Using a Torture Claim Against the Catholic Church. Lee, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thanks. I'm very pleased to be here.
Writing earlier this month, you predicted in your column for the Wall Street Journal that if the Convention Against Torture stretched this treaty about torture to apply to the Vatican in these cases, it was going to weaken the treaty. What has that committee done recently, and has it had that result, you think?
Well, what the committee has most recently done is they stopped short of actually saying that the Vatican had violated the convention, but they went on to list a number of what in diplo-speak are called concerns, which effectively state that as far as the committee is concerned, the church is responsible basically for at a minimum what its priests and other clergy do worldwide, and that the church has an obligation to effectively enforce the treaty against or ensure the compliance with the treaty of those individuals. The real problem with that, I mean, there are a lot of problems with that, actually, from a legal perspective, though, of course, the fact is the church doesn't actually control all of its clergy. I mean, it as a spiritual matter, of course, it has the right to say who and who may not be considered a priest, who may and may not preach it in Catholic fora and teach in Catholic schools and such. Sometimes it is obeyed, and sometimes it is not. But on the secular side, which is what this treaty deals with, the church has no authority over the its clergy in sovereign states. Take the United States again. The Catholic clergy here are, by and large, of course, unless you have visitors, American citizens. They are subject to the laws of the United States. They are prosecutable in state and federal courts. The Vatican's ability to enforce this treaty against them is really nugatory. I mean, minimal. Only if, in theory, they happen to be, you know, within the 100 acres of the Vatican City, could there potentially be any enforcement action brought. The fact is that the obligation to enforce it is with the United States government, and indeed there have been prosecutions. I mean, and indeed child abuse, of course, is prosecuted usually, of course, at the state level all the time. But when you start taking this treaty that was meant to be directed at the worst types of state-sponsored torture, of what we would all agree is torture, you know, cigarette burns, hot iron, you know, the whole list of you know, the mind of man is capable of coming up with some pretty awful things. When you start applying that in a way that says, well, wait a second, we have this institution that does have some control over individuals around the world, and therefore we're going to require it to try to enforce the treaty against those individuals, it starts to move away from this treaty being a document that binds states and requires states to do certain things, and it starts to transform it little by little into a document that may well be applied on a more private basis to the acts of private individuals, and that was never the intent. And once you do that, you of course begin to diminish its original purpose, which was obviously a very important one. Which again is a very long way of answering your question, but that I think is it.
So we're talking here about a basic misapplication of the treaty. I mean, are you contending here then that had the UN want to make a definitive statement about the priestly abuse scandal and the responsibility that the church may or may not bear for it, they can do it without trying to shoehorn it into a treaty on torture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there would have been various other potential fora for them to do that, if that, you know, and there are various UN bodies, and a similar action was taken by a treaty body that was formed to oversee the Treaty on the Rights of the Child, which the United States has actually not ratified, but or at least has not ratified the principal part of that treaty, and did the same sort of thing. Now that I think it got, you know, I think it was wrong because once again it misinterpreted the authority that the church actually exercises over the individuals that make up its clergy and hierarchy in individual countries. But it was certainly a less damaging than using the torture convention, because of course the torture convention was and is a critical document that is designed to control what states do to people, mostly within their own territory, and it is a very important instrument.
Now, there was another element to this story that you addressed briefly in your May 5 piece for the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was other petitions were made to this committee having to do with the church's stand on reproductive rights
right.
and contraception. Did that get any traction whatsoever with the committee?
Well, it didn't in terms of the ultimate findings, the ultimate conclusions and recommendations. In terms of that, they really relied on the idea that the church somehow exercises a control over Catholic clergy. But there clearly was an effort, a very powerful effort by non-governmental organization interest groups before the UN, this UN body, to get them to base some of this on the church's teaching on things like abortion and things like same-sex marriage and birth control and such, because of course there's very powerful interest groups that oppose those views and would have been delighted had you know, to the extent that a UN body would specifically condemn the church for that. Now, of course, I should say, you know, there are a number of UN bodies who take diametrically opposed positions to the church on all of those issues, but getting one to actually condemn the church for its teaching on those issues would have been something they very much would like to have had, and in which they did not, at least did not directly get.
So I guess legally here is the real problem severalfold. One, the kind of responsibility that the UN committee might have sought to assign the Vatican simply can't be made on a legal basis. And then the definition of torture here is being legally stretched as well.
Right.
Those are the two basic issues.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's right.
So finally, where does this go from here? What kind of a force, legal force, does a pronouncement of a UN committee on torture have with the Vatican?
Well, it as with any other, you know, state party to the torture convention, and I, you know, should note that obviously over the years the United States has also had similar documents issued with respect to it, especially with respect to some of the war on terror policies. They don't have any legal enforcement authority. I mean, it's not as if they can take either the Vatican to court, they can't freeze assets. They really don't have any power to impose any true sanction. Their conclusions are taken seriously by the diplomatic community and by the treaty parties, and no one likes to be either condemned or have conclusions made that suggest that you have not fulfilled your obligations. Sometimes that happens. I think the church was, you know, the Vatican was particularly concerned because, being a religious institution, it is very concerned with the moral side of this. Obviously, the U.S., you know, when it was sort of before the committee, was concerned with the moral side too. But you know, the bottom line is one of real politic in terms of defending the national interest. So I think it was probably less of a concern than it is to the Vatican. But the truth is, there's nothing legally that they can do. Now, what it may mean is that there will be places in the world where Catholics may be targeted because of this, for as being somehow, you know, responsible for these actions, which of course everyone agrees are wrong and should be punished, both spiritually and criminally, which is of course the job of local, you know, civil prosecutors and enforcement authorities, but by and large it's a symbolic statement, but you know, nonetheless one that over time could lead to some results that really were not foreseen or intended at the time this treaty was adopted.
So really, it sounds like what we're dealing with here is two different types of responsibility, because it came out in the hearings that of this committee that the Vatican actually had overseen the defrocking of some 900 priests in the course of the last decade or so, and discipline of, I guess, close to 3,000 more, and that's just the ones that the Vatican had direct complaints on. So it sounds like they're taking their form of responsibility. Does the responsibility for any kind of criminal actually really lie not with the church, but with that entity you just mentioned, depending on the nation, the state, whatever it may be, the local law enforcement agencies and prosecutors?
Absolutely. As I said, here priests are subject to the laws of the United States. Mostly, they're citizens of the United States. That's true in every other country where, every other country around the world. And they get no particular, one thing that did not interestingly figure in this, they have no immunity based on their status as clergy or part of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. They are subject to each and every law, just as each and every one of us is subject to it, and can be prosecuted and punished by the civil authority. There can be no argument about that, and that is something that really the committee simply ignored. The idea being that, well, look, if all these people really are part of the Vatican, then aren't they really kind of immune? I mean, don't they? The Vatican City is a sovereign state, and ordinarily your representatives overseas, diplomatic anyway, have immunity. And isn't there some? Of course, there's not. But they didn't grapple with that, because of course it would have led them to a different conclusion.
Lee Casey is an attorney in Washington, D.C., formerly served in the Justice Department during the Reagan and first Bush administrations, and is co-author of a recent column for the Wall Street Journal titled Using a Torture Claim Against the Catholic Church. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Lee, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about Christian marriage and fellowship. We don't usually think of Christian marriage in those terms. Should we? We'll get an answer to that question with Pastor John Drosendahl right after this.
No matter the size, big or small, RP Lumber can deliver it all. From pickups to one-tons to box trucks and booms, everywhere you look, you see blue. RP Blue. RP prides itself in customer service. RP will deliver quality products to your home, business, or job site. And you can be sure of timely delivery on clean trucks with courteous drivers. So when you think of service, think blue. RP Blue. With over 50 local community locations, for 37 years, RP Lumber.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Does your church need a backup organist? The Virtual Organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Are spiritual warfare and demon possession only found in the time of Jesus and the apostles? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is I Am Not Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. I Am Not Afraid, Demon Possession and Spiritual Warfare, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, 1-800-325-3040.